This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Jewish people pride themselves of in this verse.
I was just thinking that it must be even more deep than the mitzvah, because even the secular Jews who don't keep anything, do you think they would turn into barbarians, or is it really the mitzvah?
No, it's not just an individual keeping the mitzvah, it's a mitzvah that has governed us over centuries and centuries, over millennia. It's the Jewish soul. Sure, it's much more than just doing the mitzvah. There are two different issues. The one is, in the area of mitzvah, the skeleton is in place. We've got to just wrap it correctly, and we've got to give it flesh, and we've got to give it meaning, and we've got to give it life and passion. But at least the skeleton is there. And in the area of civilization, the same thing. We are inherently civilized people. We sometimes act in uncivilized ways, but that's the act. That's the uncivilization is the act. So you'll sit next to a Jewish person in a restaurant, and he'll be eating in a bad way. That's terrible. You shouldn't be doing that. But the chances are he's not going to put anybody into an oven or into a gas chamber. That he's not going to do. So he needs to learn how to eat, so we can teach him how to eat. When we teach him how to eat with manners, he'll be just fine. But you can't take a German and teach him how not to put people into ovens. That you can't do. He's going to do it over and over again, and has done for all these years. That barbarism is there, and it's not going to go away.
Is it in every other society besides Jews?
The barbaric nation, absolutely. Look at the Chinese, look at the Japanese. The Japanese are so civilized on the outside. So, and they're the cruelest, most vicious nation. And they're so civilized. I've seen a Japanese lose his temper. Very few people have seen it. And that's a tourist attraction like you can't imagine. Because you just don't. Have you ever seen a Japanese lose his temper? I mean, lose it. Just lose it. A normal sane, not a mad one, a normal sane businessman lose his temper. I tell you, I've never seen... You cannot imagine anything so wild. You cannot imagine. I mean, breaking furniture and throwing things out. You cannot imagine. And then in a second, he went, and he was back, bowing graciously, and the veneer was back again. It was the most frightening thing to see, the speed with which the primitive nature came out. And we saw that. How long did it take for the Germans to go wild? Minutes. Within minutes they became hooligans. So you can't become a hooligan in a minute. You are a hooligan, and for a few hundred years you had a veneer, you behaved yourself. You don't become a hooligan in a moment. You are a hooligan. And we see it in virtually everywhere. It's interesting in the work that we're doing at the moment with the Department of Justice, and part of the work that we're doing revolves around racism and the Holocaust. And we show them some clippings of Hitler's activities in Nazi Germany, and we ask them firstly whether anything that Hitler did would be illegal in the United States. Do you know what the answer is? No. Nothing that he did would be illegal in the United States. Nothing that he personally did would be illegal in the United States. And could it happen in the United States? And the general consensus is absolutely yes. Absolutely yes. But when you see some of the viciousness of what is already happening and being said, a charismatic leader who could take a whole lot of people with him in a situation of recession when everybody's angry. Do you remember during the 1970s, during the oil crisis in the United States, when people were shooting each other at garage stations, at petrol stations? Do you remember that? Remember that people were actually shooting each other because they were standing in line? That's barbaric behavior, because they can't get their gas. That's not civilization. And the pressure's on. And Jews don't do that. They do other things that are wrong, but the things they do that are wrong can be learned right. They're not inherently hooligans. And that's something that's in all our criticism of ourselves and of our nation, we've got to bear in mind that the area in which we're weak is generally the external. The area in which we're strong is generally the internal, and that's better than the other way around. It's not good. I have to be right in everything, but it's better than the other way around.
Is it internal conversion?
The only way that one can explain conversion is as it's explained in the Kabbalah, that conversion only works with souls who are inherently Jewish, with souls who were actually at Sinai. that conversion actually doesn't work with somebody who is inherently a non-Jew. So, and that's why it depends what attracts a person to Judaism. If the person is attracted by the Torah, there's an assumption that there's something in his soul and in the Torah that links, and that this was a Jewish soul to start with.
And were there Japanese and Asian people
at that time? I would doubt it somehow.
But maybe
conversion for marriage is different. Conversion for marriage does not mean you were at Sinai, that means you're alive.
Why is that feeling?
No, you can't. If you went to Sinai, you can't acquire it. So the current question is, when I say that, you can't talk about a Chinese soul, an Oriental soul, or whatever it was. Souls are souls. So who knows where these souls land up.
Back to Abraham when he sent Keturah, couldn't it? Keturah wasn't Jewish?
No, the whole thing was the B'nai Keturah. There could be some kind of linkage, and the Koreans like to say that they're really Jewish, and why they want to be Jewish, I can't imagine. What would be in it for them? And there are all sorts of nations that say that they come from that lineage, but that's the whole nation. Here we're talking about an individual who craves Jewishness, whose soul craves Jewishness. What might happen that a person's introduction to Jewishness is through a relationship. That a man meets a woman, or vice versa, and through that he or she is introduced to Judaism, and it inspires the soul. And the conversion process is meant to check, is this an inspired soul, or is this an expedient person who wants a husband or a wife? And we're supposed to sort it out, and that's why an Orthodox conversion is difficult, and that's why people have conservative conversions instead, because there's no such process of sorting it out. And then we land up, if the conversion process isn't proper to sort it out, and you know yourself with the person that you were seeing who was converting, but at the end what stopped him converting was when he learnt what true Judaism was, he had to feel, doesn't inspire my soul. I think it's great, but it's just not for me. And the process, a proper conversion process, is designed to confront that. Are you sure this is really inspiring you? Not that you're willing to do it, but it actually inspires you. And where it doesn't, there shouldn't be a conversion. And where there is a conversion, we land up bringing into the nation people who have gone through some kind of technical process but are not Jewish. And then their children are not Jewish. And then you get a complete mess in there. And that's a language question.
Why is it that this, like, say, Jews in Israel or Jews between each other argue so much, and that Jews are so anti-Torah and then pro-Torah and they hate each other? And they, I mean... If essentially we're more alike than we are, than other nations.
Very good, very simple reason for that. You go into any business and see how the partners in the business will relate to each other if one partner is squandering the assets of the business. Mm-hmm. See how comfortably they sit down to dinner together. If the Jewish people is about Torah, how do you think they're going to feel about one another when one party is squandering it and belittling it? And this is our business. Torah is our business. This is not just something that we do. So of course we're going to be passionate and angry about it. And how is the one who's squandering it going to feel when the other one starts taking measures against it? That's saying, in that case you can't do this, and in that case you're not going to be able to have authority over this, and starts ring-fencing him. Then he's not going to feel to it. Then he's going to say, you hate me, and you resent me, and you don't respect me. And what about the way we're meant to treat each other, and where's our brotherly love, and we've been good partners all this time? And of course, it's something we're going to be passionate about. The fact that we're passionate about is our biggest saving grace. If it was the United States, if Israel was the United States, how would it be? You don't want Judaism, that's fine. And you want to marry Arabs, that's fine. And you want to keep Shabbos, that's fine. And let's all be friends together. But the United States isn't like that when it comes to money. Isn't that so? When it comes to money, we're not all fine. Then there's right and there's wrong, and there's good and there's bad, and it's mine and it's yours. And we'll fight to the bitter death for it. What is important to us, God will judge us by what we fought about. And the Jews fight about the Torah.
So God, that's okay with God?
And how it's okay with God?
I thought he didn't like seeing the sin.
Sorry? Absolutely. We fight, and what are we going to tolerate? An internal undermining of the Torah. When we fought wars outside us, of course there's going to be embattlement. But at least that means, what are the Jews fighting about? What are the arguments about? Pick up a newspaper. What are you reading in Israel about whether this business is taking over this business? about sort of some film star was seen in some restaurant. That's not what you read in the newspaper. You read in the newspaper about should the religious be forcing the religious, and should things be clothed on Shabbos, and shouldn't they be clothed on Shabbos. Where in the world would you read that in the news? That's the issue. Those are the things that the society is being torn about. That's incredible. That's wonderful. That's not negative. That's unbelievable. It's the most exciting place to read newspapers. Yeah. Isn't that right? But it's like so terribly boring.
And yet, the Jews have always, like, wasn't it Jews in Russia who said things and then caused all kinds of problems for yeshivas? The secular Jews caused problems to close yeshivas.
Those were ideological battles, but they were ideological. At least the battle was ideological. I'm not saying the battle, it's good to have battles. I'm saying if you're battling, what are you battling about? What are you fighting about? Are you fighting about something real, or are you fighting about something stupid? The fight is destructive and is bad, but at least the fight is about something worthwhile. The fight is about an ideal. The fight is about a way of living. The fight is about the Torah. And one sees then that to the Jewish nation, even to the secular Jew, it's real, because you don't fight about something that isn't real. You don't fight about something that doesn't affect you deeply. And they're affected by it as well. So the fact that they're fighting is also positive. When we talk, and this links into something I was saying in the Menshu this morning, when we talk about the Jewish problems being on the surface, being on the at the point of interface, and that makes change easier because you're confronting it all the time, that only works if there's a certain social pressure to create change and to make change. If there's no social pressure to create change, then there isn't. And the Rambam said this morning something really fascinating. He's talking about how everything we do has to be for a purpose. That what differentiates the human being from the animal is that the human being is strategic. He can figure out that although this is a pleasant experience, it's not going to be good for me down the line, so I shouldn't do it now. And that's the essence of humanity. And the animal does what he instinctively feels like doing at that particular time. He can't think forward, and he can't calculate, and he can't figure out. And therefore the Rambam says, for example, that studying medicine is an incredibly high level of avodas Hashem. That it's not like any other business. That medicine is a mission, and it's not because you're saving lives, and that's not the issue. The reason, the most amazing reason, and here you see why the Rambam became a doctor. Because the Rambam wrote this when he was 18, long before he became a doctor, and you see his thinking. He says, in medicine, you're dealing with health issues. And what is health issues? Health issue is, even though you want to do A, you shouldn't do A because it's not healthy. That process of thinking, he says, is a process of kedusha, that sanctity. To think that way is already the beginning of sanctity, because you're differentiating yourself from an animal. You're evaluating actions and food and practices on the basis of their ultimate impact rather than on their initial taste. And therefore the discipline that the doctor is involved in, that the physician is involved in, is a discipline that has a great deal of sanctity in it, and that differentiates a human being from the animal. And he goes right through and says everything we do therefore has to have some kind of higher purpose, that nothing we should do should be done without a higher purpose. And he goes into everything, entertainment included, and the relationships, and speech is one of the things. So the things you say must have a higher purpose, otherwise don't say them. And even though he talks about light talk and jokes and things, when there is a place for it, when there isn't, and what its purpose is, but one of the things he says is one of the forms of speech that he encourages is speech that highlights bad conduct and bad people. And everybody was quite shocked and thought, but that's Lashon Hara. See, that's
he
part
encourages.
He encourages it. You know, it's part of the American non-confrontation. Why should we speak badly about bad people? You know, let them do their thing, and let me do my thing. And who am I to say it's bad? And who are they to say it's bad? If it's legal, you know, this is a country that if it's not illegal, then it's personal. Then it's personal preference. And that's why the whole debate is simply whether to legislate it or not to legislate it. But if it's not legislated, and that's why in the homosexuality, for example, there's such an objection to people taking a side on it. It's not illegal, and therefore keep quiet. It's none of your business. Anything that's not illegal is none of your business. And the Rambam said that you can't build a society like that. And he uses as his proof the Torah. He says, God says, don't do like the Egyptians do. And the God tells us the whole story of Sodom, that's Lashon Hara. and he tells us that Moshe lost his temper, that's Lashon Hara. And he tells us that David HaMelech had a relationship with Bathsheba, that's Lashon Hara. Why does the Torah tell us that? To tell us that it's not okay, that God doesn't approve of these things. And therefore speech that highlights wrongdoing is as important as speech that highlights good people. So just as you talk well of a tzaddik and the things that he does, so you've got to talk badly of a Rosh or a wicked person and the things he does, not the things you think he might have done, that's speculation and gossip, the things that he publicly does, and how important that is in the process of education and the process of communication. And I explained that it used to be that a person who did public wrong was aware of it. And where did you feel it, for example, and until today, except in parts of America, an Orthodox shul, some Orthodox shuls make a person who doesn't keep Shabbos feel unwelcome. You know that. But the tendency today is that's not right, because people who don't keep Shabbos don't know, and there's a chance for them to become involved. So generally the move is to make people who don't keep Shabbos feel welcome. But there are still many Orthodox shuls that will not give an aliyah to a person who doesn't come, who drives on Shabbos or who publicly desecrates the Shabbos. So that there's some sense of understanding of a standard. You're welcome in our shul and come home for dinner and feel comfortable and use the facilities of the shul, and you're part of us and you're one of us. But still, you've got to understand that it's Shabbos today, and the purpose of reading the Torah is because of Shabbos, and you can't break Shabbos and be called up to the Torah. It just doesn't fit. So in Lashon in Johannesburg, we never called up. We would make people feel very welcome no matter how they came, but people weren't called up to the Torah and Shabbos. So some shuls have done away with that. So the only thing that was left was at least intermarriage. A person marries out. At least that, a person should feel that that's not okay. Because it's not for that person. That person has decided to marry out already. It's finished. It's for everybody else. It's for the children. What should children feel if there's no cost to marry out? Why should they marry in? The fact is there's a bigger choice out than in. And look, we're black. The non-Jewish world has more attractive people. A bigger choice of more attractive people. So what is there that will keep... Why should a Jew marry in? We're crazy to expect the Jewish nation to survive other than a small group of people in Mattersdorf and Meir Shorim and a few in New York and a few Hasidim with long beards, and that will be the Jewish nation. If we tolerate it the way we do, that there's absolutely no sanction that a person can marry out, and marrying out and a reform or a conservative conversion is marrying out. There's no such thing as a conservative conversion, a reform conversion. There's a conversion or there's not a conversion. A conversion is defined in the Shulchan Aruch. It's very clear what a conversion is. If that's not kept, it is not a conversion. If it is not, no matter how many times the person's dipped into the mikveh, it makes no difference. That's not a conversion. And if it's not a conversion, that person is not Jewish. If that person is not Jewish, then that person's spouse has married a non-Jew. That's where we're at. And the continuous honoring of people, irrespective of who they are or what they are, what message does that give out? That gives out that we have no standard and nothing's important. We would like you to marry him, but if you don't, it's okay. We would like you to keep Shabbos, but if you don't, it's okay. We would like you to keep Moshe, but if you don't, it's okay. So why bother? Where's the pressure? Unless one has grown up with it and one has learnt it. What would make a person feel that this is important to my society, this is important to my community, this is important to who I am, if we don't do that? And therefore the Rambam says we have an obligation to point this out and to mention it and to confront it. Because when you confront these external things, then there can be change. If we're not going to confront them, then there isn't going to be change. But that's part of what the Jewish people are saying here. I'm happy that the problem is external, because I can see it, because my friends can see it, we can talk about it, we can address it, and we can change it. The reason the non-Jewish world won't change is not because you cannot change the internal. Over a period of time, you probably can change the internal. The reason the non-Jewish won't change is because it looks too good. That's why it won't change. Switzerland is the country I feel most uncomfortable in. I feel more uncomfortable in Switzerland than in Germany. Mm-hmm. It's the most discomforting, disquieting society, and I've always hated it. Long before this came up with what they were doing during the war. Because it looks too perfect. Everything, it's just too perfect. And you know what's under. You know what's under there. All the financing the Nazis and stealing the Jewish money. And all with a cloak of respectability. At least the Nazis did it openly and they got hammered for it. Everybody saw what they were. But until recently, and even now, the Swiss have this veil of dignity and sophistication and perfection. They're barbarians the same as anybody else, but they're barbarians who will never change. They will be barbarians longer than the Germans, because they'll never be exposed because of their clockwork. It all just works perfectly. Just too perfect. And it just covers, it's a veneer that covers everything up. You've got to read the books of Paul Erdman. Their novels. Paul Erdman in the first one, I've forgotten what they're all financial, they're all financial novels. They're wonderful, they're about the banking world. But he writes in the introduction to the first one that he's grateful to the Swiss government because they gave him time as their guest to apply his mind to writing these novels. What he means, he was in jail. And he was in jail for exposing the dishonesty of the Swiss banking system. They try to get rid of him, but in his books you see how they work and you see what it is. It's a despicable nation. And God gave them this beauty, this natural beauty, and God, it's amazing. There is no nation that works so well. In a superficial sense, there's no more comfortable place to be because everything is so perfect. But you feel that the people aren't perfect. You feel that there's a viciousness deep, deep, deep underneath the surface. And that's what the Nesra say. At least we don't look good. Physically we don't look good. You look at us and all the problems when Jews are depicted, it's external features, it's external things. Even Hitler, what did he find about us? What did he find about us? What did he say about us? Nasty, horrible things, but they're all superficial. They're dirty and they're this and they're that. They're all superficial things. Even if that was true, God forbid, we can clean. We can get right. No, it's not true, but they can't find anything else on us. There isn't anything else on us. They know that deep down we have a value system, we have a quality, we have a belief in God, we have a civilization. That's who we are when you pry deep down. But then when you scratch the surface, it's like these furniture that they make nowadays. It looks beautiful. You scratch off the surface and what's underneath? Chipboard. That's all it is. It's a chipboard. A veneer. We live in a world of veneer. As long as it looks good, that's great, that's fine. We don't want to scratch under the surface. But Jews do scratch under the surface because we're confident with what's under the surface. We know what's under the surface. And we're embarrassed about our outside. We're not saying it's great. We're embarrassed by it. But we can fix it. And we're proud about that.
When we find Jews who have done something wrong financially, is that the surface or is that underneath? What's that?
When I say it's the surface or it's not, what we're talking about really is the Jewish soul. So you have an individual who didn't have this, but the nation is healthy. But deep down in the nation it's healthy. Financial deceit is surface. Murder is deep. Financial deceit is because I'm greedy. Okay, so if this is greedy, he steals, shouldn't have done such terrible things, bad. But murder, you get nothing out of it. Violence is where the soul is problematic, because you get nothing out of it. Violence is a terrible thing. And so there are various other areas. That one has to be real. Next week I have a problem.
Any chance
of being
there
all night? Who's next week? Of course, I'm this is going next week. And then the rest of August, if I got the poem, is it afterwards is Tisha, or is there one more? So from Tisha B'Av till the end of August, we won't have Shira. Probably the last Friday we will, but not
yeah,
there could be some kind of linkage, and the Koreans like to say that they're really Jewish, and why they want to be Jewish, I can't imagine. What would be in it for them, and there are all sorts of nations that say that they come from that lineage, but that's the whole nation. Here we're talking about an individual who craves Jewishness, whose soul craves Jewishness. What might happen that a person's introduction to Jewishness is through a relationship, that a man meets a woman or vice versa, and through that he or she is introduced to Judaism and it inspires the soul. And the conversion process is meant to check, is this an inspired soul or is this an expedient person who wants a husband or a wife? And we're supposed to sort it out, and that's why an Orthodox conversion is difficult, and that's why people have conservative conversions instead, because there's no such process of sorting it out. And then we land up, if the conversion process isn't proper to sort it out, and you know yourself with the person that you were seeing who was converting, what at the end, what stopped him converting was when he learnt what true Judaism was, he had to feel, doesn't inspire muscle. I think it's great, but it's just not for me. And the process, a proper conversion process, is designed to confront that. Are you sure this is really inspiring you? Not that you're willing to do it, but it actually inspires you. And where it doesn't, there shouldn't be a conversion. And where there is a conversion, we land up bringing into the nation people who have gone through some kind of technical process but are not Jewish. And then their children are not Jewish. And then you've got a complete mess in there. And that's a long discussion.
Why is it that this, like, say, Jews in Israel or Jews between each other argue so much, and that Jews are so anti-Torah and then pro-Torah and they hate each other? And they, I mean, if essentially we're more alike than we are, there's other
reasons. Very good, very simple reason for that. You go into any business and see how the partners in the business will relate to each other if one partner is squandering the assets of the business. See how comfortably they'll sit down to dinner together. If the Jewish people is about Torah, how do you think they're going to feel about one another when one party is squandering it and belittling it? And this is our business. Torah is our business. This is not just something that we do. So of course we're going to be passionate and angry about it. And how is the one who's squandering it going to feel when the other one starts taking measures against it? That's saying, in that case you can't do this, and in that case you're not going to be able to have authority over this, and starts ring-fencing him. But he's not going to feel to it. Then he's going to say, you hate me, and you resent me, and you don't respect me. And what about the way we're meant to treat each other, and where's our brotherly love, and we've been good partners all this time? And of course, it's something we're going to be passionate about. The fact that we're passionate about is our biggest saving grace. If it was the United States, if Israel was the United States, how would it be? You don't want Judaism, that's fine. And you want to marry Arabs, that's fine. And you want to keep Shabbos, that's fine. And let's all be friends together. But the United States isn't like that when it comes to money. Isn't that so? When it comes to money, we're not all fine. Then there's right and there's wrong, and there's good and there's bad, and it's mine and it's yours. And we'll fight to the bitter death for it. What is important to us, God will judge us by what we fought about. And the Jews fight about the Torah.
So God, that's okay with God?
And how it's okay with God?
I thought he didn't like Stephen's
sin. Sorry? Absolutely. We fight, and what are we going to tolerate? An internal undermining of the Torah. When we fought wars outside, so of course there's going to be embattlement. But at least that means, what are the Jews fighting about? What are the arguments about? Pick up a newspaper. What are you reading in Israel? About whether this business is taking over this business? About whether some film star was seen in some restaurant? That's not what you read in the newspaper. You read in the newspaper about should the religious be forcing the irreligious, and should things be closed on Shabbos, and shouldn't they be closed on Shabbos? Where in the world would you read that in the news? That's the issue. Those are the things that the society is being torn about. That's incredible. That's wonderful. That's not negative. That's unbelievable. It's the most exciting place to read newspapers. Yeah. Isn't that right? The newspapers are terribly boring.
And yet, the Jews have always, wasn't it Jews in Russia who said things and then caused all kinds of problems for yeshivas? The secular Jews caused problems to close yeshivas and say,
those were ideological battles, but they were ideological. At least the battle was ideological. I'm not saying the battle, it's good to have battles. I'm saying if you're battling, what are you battling about? What are you fighting about? Are you fighting about something real, or are you fighting about something stupid? The fight is destructive and is bad, but at least the fight is about something worthwhile. The fight is about an ideal. The fight is about a way of living. The fight is about the Torah. And one sees them to the Jewish nation, even to the secular Jew, it's real, because you don't fight about something that isn't real. You don't fight about something that doesn't affect you deeply. And they're affected by it as well. So the fact that they're fighting is also positive. When we told Ms. Linkson to something I was saying in the men's shiur this morning, when we talk about the Jewish problems being on the surface, being on at the point of interface, and that makes change easier because you're confronting it all the time, that only works if there's a certain social pressure to create change and to make change. If there's no social pressure to create change, then then there isn't. And the Rambam said this morning something very fascinating. He said, he's talking about how everything we do has to be for a purpose, that what differentiates the human being from the animal is that the human being is strategic. He can figure out that although this is a pleasant experience, it's not going to be good for me down the line, so I shouldn't do it now. And that's the essence of humanity. And the animal does what he instinctively feels like doing at that particular time. He can't think forward, and he can't calculate, and he can't figure out. And therefore the Rambam says, for example, that studying medicine is an incredibly high level of avodas Hashem. That it's not like any other business. But medicine is a mission, and it's not because you're saving lives, and that's not the issue. The reason, the most amazing reason, and here you see why the Rambam became a doctor. Because the Rambam wrote this when he was 18, long before he became a doctor, and you see his thinking. He says, in medicine, you're dealing with health issues. And what is health issues? Health issue is, even though you want to do A, you shouldn't do A because it's not healthy. That process of thinking, he says, is a process of kedusha, that's sanctity. To think that way is really the beginning of sanctity, because you're differentiating yourself from an animal. You're evaluating actions and food and practices on the basis of their ultimate impact rather than on their initial taste. And therefore the discipline that the doctor is involved in, that the physician is involved in, is a discipline that has a great deal of sanctity in it, and that differentiates the human from the animal. And he goes right through and says everything we do therefore has to have some kind of higher purpose, that nothing we should do should be done without a higher purpose. And he goes into everything, entertainment included, and the relationships, and speech is one of the things. So the things you say must have a higher purpose, otherwise don't say them. And even though he talks about light talk and jokes and things, when there is a place for it, when there isn't, and what its purpose is, but one of the things he says is one of the forms of speech that he encourages is speech that highlights bad conduct and bad people. And everybody was quite shocked and thought, but that's Lashon Hara. See, that's
he
part
encourages.
Of, he encourages it. You know, it's part of the American non-confrontation. Why should we speak badly about bad people? You know, let them do their thing, and let me do my thing. And who am I to say it's bad? And who are they to say it's bad? If it's legal, you know, this is a country that if it's not illegal, then it's personal. Then it's personal preference. And that's why the whole debate is simply whether to legislate it or not to legislate it. But if it's not legislated, and that's why in homosexuality, for example, there's such an objection to people taking a side on it. It's not illegal, and therefore keep quiet. It's none of your business. Anything that's not illegal is none of your business. And the Rambam said, if you can't build a society like that, and he uses as his proof the Torah. He says, God says, don't do like the Egyptians do. And the God tells us the whole story of Sodom, that's Lashon Hara. And he tells us that Moshe lost his temper, that's Lashon Hara. And he tells us that David HaMelech had a relationship with Bathsheba, that's Lashon Hara. Why does the Torah tell us that? To tell us that it's not okay, that God doesn't approve of these things. And therefore speech that highlights wrongdoing is as important as speech that highlights good people. So just as you talk well of a tzaddik and the things that he does, so you've got to talk badly of a Rosh or a wicked person and the things he does. Not the things you think he might have done, that's speculation and gossip, the things that he publicly does. And how important that is in the process of education and the process of communication. And I explained that it used to be that a person who did public wrong was aware of it. And where did you feel it, for example, and until today, except in parts of America, an Orthodox shul. Some Orthodox shuls make a person who doesn't keep shuls feel unwelcome. You know that. But the tendency today is that's not right, because people who don't keep Shabbos don't know, and there's a chance for them to become involved. So generally the move is to make people who don't keep Shabbos feel welcome. But there are still many Orthodox shuls that will not give an aliyah to a person who doesn't come, who drives on Shabbos or who publicly desecrates the Shabbos. So that there's some sense of understanding of a standard. You're welcome in our shul and come home for dinner and feel comfortable and use the facilities of the shul, and you're part of us and you're one of us. But still, you've got to understand that it's Shabbos today, and the purpose of reading the Torah is because of Shabbos, and you can't break Shabbos and be called up to the Torah. It just doesn't fit. So in my shul in Johannesburg, we never called up. We would make people feel very welcome no matter how they came, but people weren't called up to the Torah on Shabbos. So some shuls have done away with that. So the only thing that was left was at least intermarriage. A person marries out. At least that, a person should feel that's not okay. Because if it's not for that person. That person has decided to marry out already. It's finished. It's for everybody else. It's for the children. What should children feel if there's no cost to marry out? why should they marry in? The fact is there's a bigger choice out than in. And look, we're black. The non-Jewish world has more attractive people, a bigger choice of more attractive people. So what is there that will keep it? Why should a Jew marry in? We're crazy to expect the Jewish nation to survive other than a small group of people in Mattersdorf and Meir Shorim and a few in New York and a few Hasidim with long beards, and that will be the Jewish nation if we tolerate it the way we do. But there's absolutely no sanction that a person can marry out, and marrying out and a reform or a conservative conversion is marrying out. There's no such thing as a conservative conversion, a reform conversion. There's a conversion or there's not a conversion. A conversion is defined in the Shulchan Aruch. It's very clear what a conversion is. If that's not kept, it is not a conversion. If it is not, no matter how many times the person's dipped into the mikveh, it makes no difference. That's not a conversion. And if it's not a conversion, that person is not Jewish. If that person is not Jewish, then that person's spouse has married a non-Jew. That's where we're at. And the continuous honoring of people, irrespective of who they are or what they are, what message is that? Does that give out? That gives out that we have no standard and nothing is important. We would like you to marry him, but if you don't, it's okay. We would like you to keep Shabbos, but if you don't, it's okay. We would like you to keep kosher, but if you don't, it's okay. So why bother? Where's the pressure? Unless one has grown up with it and one has learnt it, what would make a person feel that this is important to my society, this is important to my community, this is important to who I am, if we don't do that? And therefore the Rambam says we have an obligation to point this out and to mention it and to confront it, because when you confront these external things, then there can be change. If we're not going to confront them, then there isn't going to be change. And that's part of what the Jewish people are saying here. I'm happy that the problem is external, because I can see it, because my friends can see it, we can talk about it, we can address it, and we can change it. The reason the non-Jewish world won't change is not because you cannot change the internal. Over a period of time, you probably can change the internal. The reason the non-Jewish won't change is because it looks too good. That's why it won't change. Switzerland is the country I feel most uncomfortable in. I feel more uncomfortable in Switzerland than in Germany. Mm-hmm. It's the most discomforting, disquieting society, and I've always hated it. Long before this came up with what they were doing during the war. Because it looks too perfect. Everything, it's just too perfect. And you know what's under, you know what's under there, all the financing the Nazis and stealing the Jewish money, and all with a cloak of respectability. At least the Nazis did it openly and they got hammered for it. Everybody saw what they were. But until recently, and even now, the Swiss have this veil of dignity and sophistication and perfection. They're barbarians the same as anybody else, but they're barbarians who will never change. They will be barbarians longer than the Germans, because they'll never be exposed because of their clockwork. It all just works perfectly. Just too perfect. And it just covers, it's a veneer that covers everything up. You've got to read the books of Paul Erdman. Novels. Paul Erdman, in the first one, I've forgotten what they're very financial. They're financial novels. They're wonderful. They're about the banking world. But he writes in the introduction to the first one that he's grateful to the Swiss government because they gave him time as their guest to apply his mind to writing these novels. What he means, he was in jail, and he was in jail for exposing the dishonesty of the Swiss banking system, they try to get rid of it, but in his books you see how they work and you see what it is. It's a despicable nation, and God gave them this beauty, this natural beauty, and God, it's amazing. There is no nation that works so well. In a superficial sense, there's no more comfortable place to be because everything is so perfect, but you feel that the people aren't perfect. You feel that there's a viciousness deep, deep, deep underneath the surface. And that's what the Bnei Yisrael say. At least we don't look good. Physically we don't look good. You look at us and all the problems when Jews are depicted, it's external features, it's external things. Even Hitler, what did he find about us? What did he find about us? What did he say about us? Nasty, horrible things, but they were all superficial. They're dirty and they're this and they're that. They're all superficial things. Even if that was true, God forbid, we can clean. We can get right. No, it's not true, but they can't find anything else on us. There isn't anything else on us. They know that deep down, we have a value system, we have a quality, we have a belief in God, we have a civilization. That's who we are when you pry deep down. within, when you scratch the surface, it's like these furniture that they make nowadays. It looks beautiful. You scratch off the surface, and what's underneath? Chipboard. That's all it is. It's a chipboard. A veneer. We live in a world of veneer. As long as it looks good, that's great. That's fine. We don't want to scratch under the surface. But Jews do scratch under the surface because we're confident with what's under the surface. We know what's under the surface. And we're embarrassed about our outside. We're not saying it's great. We're embarrassed by it. But we can fix it. And that's, and we're proud about that.
Is when we find Jews who've done something wrong financially, is that the surface or is that underneath? What's that?
When I say it's the surface or it's not, what we're talking about really is the Jewish soul. So you'll have an individual who didn't have this, but the nation is healthy. The deep down in the nation it's healthy. Financial deceit is surface. Murder is deep. Financial deceit is because I'm greedy. Okay, so if this is greedy, he steals. Shouldn't have done such terrible things. Bad. But murder, you get nothing out of. Violence is where the soul is problematic, because you get nothing out of it. Violence is a terrible thing. And so there are various other areas. That one has to be there. Next week I have a problem. Who's next week? Four sentences. Let's go next week. And then the rest of August, if I got the poem, is it afterwards the Tisha, or is there one more? So from Tisha B'Av to the end of August, we won't have Shirim. Probably the last Friday we will, but not on. You'll have to be patient.